Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell with ESPN. We are here on January 7th. It's Monday, 2019. The wild card round of this NFL season has wrapped up. I don't know that we had any great games in terms of the quality of play, but definitely some fun ones. We had three pretty close games and a blowout with the Colts and Texans. We'll get to Indianapolis and Houston later, but I think we have to start with the Eagles and Bears game from Sunday afternoon, the final game of the weekend. And joining us to talk about that and the rest of these wild card games, making his not contractual, but might as well be contractual monthly appearance here on the Bill Barnwell Show, it is CBS's Will Brinson. Will, how are you?
How's it going, Bill? Happy to fulfill my obligations for January. I do like that this is a running gag, although I am sure at some point some legal muckety-muck, either at ESPN or CBS, will catch wind of our joke and be like, whoa, you can't contract him for a buy. We're like, you can't be contracted to Bill Barnwell. And I'm like, it's a joke. That's the problem with 2019 we'll be able to get jokes. Right, maybe that'll be the nice thing about 2019 is we'll be able to Venmo kickers and get jokes. That's all I'm looking for in life.
2019 does not strike me as the year where people will finally figure out jokes on the internet. But as you pointed out, you can Venmo not only kickers but people who are posing as kickers on the internet.
Yeah, pretty incredible. I use Venmo mostly so I don't look like an old doofus when we have visitors at our house, and they're like, hey. There's this awkward exchange. There's always between like the dad and the babysitter where they're like, they don't tell you how much it is. You're just supposed to know because your wife told you. It's an exorbitant amount. You're surprised by it, but you don't want to say that. You try to start to write a check and they give you this side eye. It's like writing, what am I supposed to do with this piece of paper, old man? And so you get Venmo so you can be cool. And so I was looking up Cody Parkey on Venmo because apparently Eagles fans, after he missed the kick, technically had the kick blocked. It was changed minutes before we started recording this to a block. People started Venmoing him, Eagles fans did. And once other people got wind of Eagles fans Venmoing Cody Parkey, they went and created fake Cody Parkey Venmo accounts so that they would accidentally be the recipients or fraudulently be the recipients of money from random Eagles fans trying to pay Cody Parkey. Again, welcome to 2019.
Just imagine, like, you telling your wife, "Hey, honey, I made $60 today. Let's go out for a nice dinner. We have a little bit of free money to work with." "Oh, how'd you make it?" "Well, I can't really explain." That's just such a weird way to try and grift someone into giving you a few dollars. I appreciate the hustle, but I don't know. That's just.
Do you think that we will in 2019 have our first Venmo grifter millionaire? will somebody retire because they're just Venmo grifters based solely on a sporting situation? Like somebody holds up their Venmo at the national championship game behind the game day sign, and then like somebody creates a fake Venmo like that and makes $1 million. I don't know. It could happen.
I hope so. I hope we get that. I hope we have an exciting enough and dramatic enough ending to a game later on in this postseason that causes someone to become perhaps the first Venmo millionaire grifter. But we had a pretty exciting one here with Eagles Bears. It was a dramatic game. We had a dramatic fourth down conversion from Nick Foles, who continued to do Nick Foles things. We had Mitchell Trubisky pretty terribly for most of this game and then was incredible for the final quarter plus once the Bears figured out that Avante Maddox was susceptible to double moves. But let's start with the end of the game. I mean, well, you know, do you, number one, are you confident that Cody Parkey's kick was tipped? Do you think that it would have gone through had it not been tipped? Do you blame the Bears for putting Cody Parkey in that situation? How do you feel about how this game ended? How much blame does Cody Parkey deserve for what happened here?
All great questions. I would say that, yes, I am 100% confident that Cody Parkey's kick was tipped. Mm-hmm. We saw shortly after, I can't get in trouble for saying it on your podcast. I was watching SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt, mm-hmm. and they did a great job of zooming in on the fingers of the Eagles defender, Trayvon. What's his last name? How am I forgetting?
Hester. They have a Trayvon and a Cravon, which is pretty remarkable.
Right. That is, and Hester, of course, you know, you get confused. He brought
it's
up
the Bears.
involving the Bears, right?
Of course.
Anyway, they zoomed in on Trayvon Hester's fingers, and you can clearly see his fingers move as they graze the ball and pop backwards, and you can see the ball sort of change trajectory. And, yeah, I mean, I think the kick was good. I think Cody Parkey, before Doug Peterson iced him, mm-hmm. piped one right through the middle, and he felt confident going out there, and the Eagles just made a great play, and they got a finger on it. And I do think you can pin some of the blame on the Bears for putting Cody Parkey in that position because they didn't have a timeout.
Mm-hmm.
There was some confusion about whether they should kick with 17 seconds left or to take a shot to the end zone. I like the play they ran with Mitchell Trubisky where they took a shot to the end zone and, mm-hmm. and Mitchell overthrew on purpose to make sure he didn't throw an interception. But in the spot where they, you know, there was at one point they completed a long pass down the field to the sidelines to Allen Robinson, and Mitchell Trubisky runs up to the huddle and he doesn't know that he's supposed to spike it. Mm-hmm. And he looks over to the sidelines like he was in college, like, what am I supposed to do? Which I thought was very telling about not only sort of how things are being run with Trubisky and maybe the limitations that he has as someone who can command a game right now,
mm-hmm.
and you know, being his first playoff game. I mean, that's a tough spot to be in. But, yeah, I thought the Bears could have done a lot of things throughout the course of this game to not rest it on Cody Parkey's leg, up to and including scoring some more points and maybe giving themselves a better shot for a touchdown there.
Well, that's the big thing, right? I mean, our friend Jeff Schwartz went on Twitter and said, you know, realistically, Cody Parkey scored 9 points in this game, and the Bears offense combined to score a total of 6 points in this game. And I think for as good as Trubisky was later in the game, he really did struggle for the first 2.5 quarters. The Eagles did a great job in terms of getting pressure on Trubisky, really did well in third down, keeping him from scrambling to pick up first downs. And I think there was the sort of frustrating thing from the Bears' perspective where they didn't get the two-pointer on the touchdown they did score. I will say, though, I talked about this on the show with Mina last week. I don't like it when we talk about plays being too cute because anything that's not typical is too cute. But what was the purpose of Khalil Mack motioning outside on that play?
I don't know. I mean, it just felt like the Bears didn't. Did you ever feel like the Bears defense was dominant at all at any point in that game? I didn't feel like we ever saw the Bear. I mean, I know that they got I think it was Next Gen Stats pointed out that Nick Foles got the ball out faster than he had all season long, mm-hmm. which is, of course, really impressive. It's a smart way to neutralize the Bears' pass rush. They couldn't, you know, the Eagles only had 1.8 yards per carry. But in general, after watching a weekend where I was extremely impressed by the Chargers and extremely impressed by the Ravens, both defensively, extremely impressed by what the Colts did to the Texans, really impressed by what the Cowboys and, I guess, Seahawks did too,
mm-hmm.
To have the Bears, the best defense in all of football, get too cute and not really ever stop Nick Foles was sort of shocking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we saw the Eagles move the ball early. Of course, those drives were ended by two interceptions. So they came up with a couple of big plays, but as the game wore on, they really didn't seem to have, you know, much of an answer for the passing game. And, of course, the Eagles only scored 16 points in this game, but they still moved the ball pretty comfortably. Foles finished 25 of 40 for 266 and those two touchdowns in addition to the two picks. Only sacked once by the Bears, second lowest sack rate for the Bears in a game this year. And, yeah, I mean, I have to admit, and I wrote about this in my column today, it's sort of tough to frame this, and I don't want to have it come off the wrong way. Carson Wentz is a better quarterback than Nick Foles, but Nick Foles' ability to get the ball out quickly and avoid sacks, which he has done at a much better level than Carson Wentz over the past 2 years, might have made him a better quarterback for this specific matchup than Carson Wentz would have been, even if Carson Wentz is the better quarterback in a vacuum.
Is it possible that Carson Wentz, I mean, yes, it is possible, but I mean, I guess I'm asking you, is it possible that Carson Wentz is a better quarterback and Nick Foles is a better quarterback for Doug Peterson?
It certainly is possible. I don't know that I would say that, but I think in this specific game it was. Now,
right.
It's hard to say how much of it is whether Nick Foles is a better quarterback for Doug Peterson in the vacuum, whether Doug Peterson does a better job of scripting a game plan and building a scheme for Nick Foles, and that if he put Carson Wentz with those same limitations, Carson Wentz might be a better quarterback. I think it's too tough to say, but at the very least, I think at this point, it's fair to wonder how much of a significant drop-off there actually is between Wentz and Foles at quarterback for the Eagles.
I mean, I think part of the thing, Bill, is that because it's Nick Foles, I just think that for whatever reason, Doug Peterson in these playoff situations with Nick Foles, I almost feel like he restricts his playbook a little bit into the compartmentalized portion that Nick Foles really likes, and maybe those just happen to be better operating plays. Remember, of course, look, in 2017, the Eagles destroyed the league for 10 weeks. I mean, they were they were comfortably the best team in football for large stretches of the previous year, and so it is recency bias to get up and excited about Nick Foles, but I do think that it's almost like because it's like if you're playing Madden against your little brother and you're beating him routinely and you're sort of clowning off, you're not really paying attention, and then like your older brother comes in the room and it's you raise the difficulty level, and as such you sort of get up for the game a little bit more. It's almost like Doug Peterson has elevated his play calling because he's had to get up for more for these games with Nick Foles, which I'm not saying he cares less. It's just like he has to heighten his senses and be more careful about what he's picking, and the stuff he's picking is so specific to what Nick Foles does and doesn't allow for the freelancing, the extension of plays, trying to make things happen on the fly that Carson Wentz thrives off of, that it almost works better for the Eagles in these playoff situations.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you this question. I think I know the answer. It makes sense to me. I think that we probably underestimate just how much of a role Peterson plays in this offense. I think we're seeing it because we're getting a rare chance to see, you know, two quarterbacks playing in meaningful situations over the course of two seasons and not like a Jameis and Ryan Fitzpatrick situation where you have one guy getting benched every few weeks because he's bad. But, you know, because of injuries, you have two guys playing at a pretty high level. And I don't know that it makes me think that the Eagles should treat, you know, Carson Wentz as if he's similar to Nick Foles, but I have to ask you, well, let's say Nick Foles runs the table and leads the Eagles to a second consecutive Super Bowl victory. Would that be enough for you to think seriously about trading Carson Wentz and sticking with Nick Foles as your quarterback? Or is there nothing that could possibly happen for you to change your mind and have Carson Wentz starting week one of 2019?
There is nothing that could happen that could make me change my mind. I do firmly, and I think that there's nothing that could happen that would make Howie Roseman change his mind. I do think that one more playoff win might, I don't even know if Nick Foles needs to run the table. I think if he beats the Saints this weekend, that Eagles fans might be like, all right, look, that's enough. Okay. I mean, like, we love Carson Wentz, but go trade this guy, get three first round picks for him. You know, don't worry about extending him with all of his injuries, and let's roll with Foles. And I think it's short-sighted. I think it is emotional. I think it is dumb. I think it is a passion play. And I think it's totally understandable because what Nick Foles is doing is just crazy. And I do believe that it sort of misses, I don't know, man. I mean, this goes beyond. Like, we like to have these rational concepts of what football is, and this is in the ether world of Tom Brady's fourth quarter comeback abilities. You know, like it just sort of goes beyond what we're supposed to understand about football. And I do think that if the Eagles decided to do that and traded Carson Wentz and went with Nick Foles, that they would end up regretting it by week five of the 2019 season, because they rushed Carson Wentz back this year. Carson Wentz back this year because Nick Foles wasn't playing up to snuff early in the season. And to me, what Nick Foles is the streakiest quarterback in NFL history. And I don't mean that as an insult. Like, he just can black out and win these playoff games, and then go lose some regular season games to, you know, to questionable teams.
Like the Bucks, for example, as we saw earlier this season. So, let's say the opposite happens. Not the opposite. Let's say the alternative, the more likely possibility happens, and Nick Foles let's say he plays well against the Saints, but they lose, and he gets franchised after the turndown option, and then he gets franchised after the season. What do you think the Eagles are getting in trade for Nick Foles on the franchise tag in March?
I saw the craziest thing on Twitter I've ever seen. It was Pete Prisco suggesting that right. Pete Prisco suggesting that my colleague and friend Pete Prisco suggesting the Jaguars might have to give up their first round pick to get Foles. I was like, what? Pete hates Foles. He doesn't like to trade picks, and he certainly wouldn't give up. He clowned me for saying that the Jaguars should give up a pick for Teddy Bridgewater last year. So I was surprised by it. I think that a first is too much, even a low first. You can't give up a mid first for a quarterback. Look at all these teams that made the playoffs this year. Six guys on their rookie deals. That's we've been talking about this for 18 months now. This is the realization in the NFL that if you have a good quarterback on a rookie deal, you can build up around him. So you can't trade for Nick Foles and then give Nick Foles a giant contract. It's going to burn you. Somebody will probably do it, but I would think that you're looking at a 2 and a 3 or 2 2s maximum for Nick Foles, which again is a whole lot. But the Eagles have a lot of leverage here.
Well, what if, for example, there was a team picking in the bottom half of the first round, very low in the first round because of a trade, who have a quarterback who is decent, has shown some signs of growth this year, but not necessarily a guy who was drafted by the person who is in charge right now. And that person who is in charge is someone who coached with Andy Reid for years, who was certainly comfortable with what he's seen from Doug Peterson's scheme, which might be similar to his own in some ways. And that person I'm referring to, of course, is John Gruden with the Raiders. At least if they think Derek Carr is not their guy, do you at least think about trading the 27th pick, which is currently 27 from the Cowboys? It could be lower by the end of this Cowboys playoff run, but do you at least think about trading 27 for Nick Foles and moving on from Derek Carr?
I don't think so. Look, I mean, and maybe I don't know what John Gruden is thinking. I'm not going to pretend to know what John Gruden is thinking. I don't think you do. If it's me and I have all these assets and I'm the Raiders, I'm trading down and acquiring more assets, and I'm trying to get as many draft picks as I can, and I'm riding out Derek Carr for one more year. I'm just kind of trying to play Gruden and trying to think how I would play this too. And I'm playing Derek Carr. I'm using him and Reggie McKenzie as a continued scapegoat should the Raiders struggle again next season. And then next year, when they're we expect that their Justin Herbert will be coming out to a Tiger Bowl. Lord, I tried. Tua will be coming out, Jake Fromm from Georgia, and there's a couple more guys. Loaded class in 2020, and then in 2021 when Trevor Lawrence is coming out. I think there's a nice little run of quarterbacks that we'll see after this year, and so I'm riding it out and trying to go with assets. But it wouldn't surprise me if John Gruden decided to do that. I think we need to. You know, I mean, it's hard to discern whether John Gruden dislikes anyone because he just doesn't have. We don't have any tape of him from his time at ESPN where he said anything mean. I don't know that Foles and Gruden strikes me as a great tandem, though.
It doesn't, but I don't know that Carr and Gruden strikes me as a great tandem.
Exactly. Yeah. So. No, I don't think they do. Foles and Carr seem cut from the same cloth in that Nick Foles seems too nice for John Gruden, and so I hope that doesn't happen. I don't think John Gruden's bad. I just think he's a rough and tumble football coach, and I don't know that it would work well. And I hope that Nick Foles goes somewhere that makes him happy.
Can I give you a quote from John Gruden about Nick Foles in 2012? As you mentioned, he said nothing mean about any NFL quarterbacks when he was at ESPN. But I will say this, quote unquote, "I love his NFL size. He reminds me a lot of Brad Johnson, from his football character to his ability to decipher a lot quickly, and we won a championship with Brad."
Maybe so. Yeah. Look, I don't think it's out of the question at all, Bill. He can call up Andy Reid. Andy Reid will, I assume, give John an honest assessment of Nick Foles. Maybe he won't. Maybe because Gruden's I don't know. I wouldn't trust anything Andy Reid told me about somebody else's quarterback. maybe he'll make the move. I don't think it would be shocking. I think it is a team that makes sense. I think it's a smart landing spot. I guess I'm just wish casting for Nick Foles that he, you know, ends up, I don't know. I just feel like he should just stay in Philly forever.
He should. I think that's smart, but it's going to take him taking a pay cut or not taking what he can get on the free market. So we will see a really fascinating spot for Nick Foles coming this offseason. But let's get to the other NFC matchup and the AFC games in a moment. But first, I wanted to talk about our pals at SeatGeek. And Guys, if you are a Cowboys fan who wants to travel on the road to check out your team, well, you probably weren't expecting to need playoff tickets. Perhaps by mid-season, it might be fair to say, but you want to head to LA, want to check your favorite team out against the Los Angeles Rams at a place that will probably be pretty Cowboys friendly, if I'm not mistaken. Well, this is your opportunity to do just that, because our pals at SeatGeek are going to get you tickets reliably and affordably. SeatGeek goes all around the web. They use their deal score technology to rate the tickets, so you know you're getting a good deal. And you don't have to go to Los Angeles for tickets that are sketchy. You're going to get tickets that you can trust are going to be real. That's the simplest way I can put it. You're going to get real tickets, and they're going to be a good deal on SeatGeek. And best of all, if you want to use SeatGeek for the first time, haven't used it previously, well, you can get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase by downloading the SeatGeek app, going to checkout with your tickets, and entering in promo code Barnwell today. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Go on the SeatGeek app, find your tickets for your big game, whether it's the Cowboys or whether anything else, sports, concerts, anything ticket-related. You can go to SeatGeek, enter in promo code Barnwell, and get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. Now back to the show. Still plenty of playoff stuff to get to. Let's talk about the Cowboys' victory over the Seahawks on Saturday night. A two-point game, a game that came in for a lot of criticism for Seattle running the football with limited or no, some might say, effectiveness. 24 carries for 73 yards, and even that was sort of popped up by a 128-yard run and Russell Wilson running three times for 14 yards. Pete Carroll did not take kindly to criticism of offensive coordinator Brian Schottenheimer after the game. What was the quote he said about this? A bunch of garbage was the phrase he used to describe people criticizing Brian Schottenheimer after the game. Well, do you think that criticism of Seattle's decision to run the football a bunch in this game is warranted? Do you think they should have thrown the football more, or is it just sort of sour grapes from a fan base that came up just short of beating the Cowboys on the road here?
No, they should have thrown the ball more. I mean, that's like, they threw it 27 times, ran it 24 times. Like you said, 3 yards a carry, which is not good, but that, to me, that belies the actual ineffectiveness of their running game in this situation. Not to mention the lack of creativity. And I think, Bill, when you look at this, what was stunning was that, they were ineffective, they lacked creativity, and they were predictable. I mean, that is the essence of what you don't want to be in modern football. You have to be creative, unpredictable, and efficient if you want to win. And we saw three times, I believe, it was they got a field goal out of it the next to last drive. I guess they had three drives in the second quarter where they had field goal opportunities. I think it was the first drive where they got a field goal, but six plays, 69 yards.
Yep.
And they came up with a field goal. They ended at Dallas's 9. And then nine plays, 44 yards to end the third quarter where they got a touchdown. Mm-hmm. And then the final drive, six plays, 75 yards where they got a touchdown and then went for two to really hose some people in Vegas and to lose by two. It was, when you look at the Cowboys' defense, they are most effective at bottling up the run because they have a very an above-average defensive line that's played very well under Rod Marinelli. They have a group of young linebackers that are excellent in pursuit in terms of Jalen Smith and Leighton Vander Esch and just will drop hammers on people. And then they play this single high safety stuff that leaves them susceptible to deep balls. Mm-hmm. And so only an idiot, and that's not fair, but only a stubborn fool would continue to run at this front seven ineffectively. The Cowboys tried to do it against the Seahawks and they didn't work, so they started passing it. The Cowboys are supposed to be the team that won't change what they want to do, and the Seahawks are supposed to be creative and have ingenuity, and they just kept running over and over again. And the three times that I mentioned when they did start passing, they were effective at moving the ball because Russell Wilson is a pinpoint deep ball thrower, and to take the ball out of his hands in these spots is just crazy. And I didn't think they would do it to my own financial and professional detriment at picking the game, and as a result they lost. They're going home. This is a Seahawks team that could have made noise in this postseason because of their skill set. They ran into a bad matchup and they didn't adjust. It's as simple as that to me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think the issue here is, it's one thing to come into this game and say, hey, we ran the ball a ton during the regular season. We got to keep that up. We have to prove that it's what we do best. It's our identity. as the Seahawks mentioned, as so many people brought up in the sort of discussion after this game. It's what the Seahawks want to do. Okay, fine. No, you know, reasonable enough. Number one, part of your job is to scout what the other team is good at and maybe try to not do what they are necessarily good at. And for the Cowboys, that's run defense. Their run defense, by any measure I can find, is considerably better than their pass defense. It certainly is borne out on tape. It's borne out in, you know, the skill sets of the players they have. I can't imagine anybody looking at the Cowboys and sitting there and saying, well, you know, they're a pretty weak run defense. We should definitely attack them via the run. But let's say you even want to do that. Let's say you think you're so dominant running the football that you're going to be good at it. The Seahawks could not run the football in this game. And when they threw, outside of, like, you know, second and 18 and third and 18, when they would check it down, Russell Wilson was awesome in this game. He made so many plays. So at some point, you know, early in the second half, you know, sort of after you have those drives in the second quarter and you are moving the ball, for, you know, like you said, the 69-yard drive that set up the field goal, the 28-yard drive on the short field that set up a second field goal, don't you sit there and say to yourself, well, we need to start throwing the ball more. We have to throw the ball as sort of the core of our offense, because the running game we had previously was not working, and we were sort of hitting our heads against the wall. And it didn't. They went back in the third quarter and did basically the same stuff, and ended up costing them an opportunity to score for the first two drives, and they had a short field for a touchdown after a long punt return they scored on. I believe that was the drive where they converted the fourth and five. Yes. So they had to, you know, have Russell Wilson hit a pinpoint pass to, extend that drive and set up for the touchdown that he scored on a, zone read keeper. But it just sort of became so frustrating because, you know, you can't play that style when you can see that it's not working. And this is even a game where, you know, you don't want to have it be a low scoring game, because for the second half, the Seahawks had no kicker. Certainly no kicker that they trusted, with Sebastian Janikowski injured and Michael Dixon apparently not capable of drop-kicking field goals, which we missed out on a glorious opportunity for that to begin. But I just, you know, I think you have to be – you don't want to be overly reactive, but you have to show some semblance of self-awareness when it comes to seeing what's happening to your team on the field. And I don't think the Seahawks did a good enough job with that. I think this was a game where they were running the ball too frequently on first and second down, putting Russell Wilson in difficult situations on third down. And even when he was still making plays, it wasn't enough for them to convince Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer to, you know, shift things in a way that might have won them the football game.
So I looked it up really quick because I was sure that I read, like I just think it's hilarious to read this after the fact. But this is what I wrote the week before making my picks piece. I picked Seahawks 17, Cowboys 14. I don't think I was off in terms of what the game would be, but I wrote, Seattle's strength is its run game, and Dallas is actually good at stopping the run. That's a serious cause for concern. But are Brian Schottenheimer, Pete Carroll, and Russell Wilson just going to run into a brick wall over and over without some success? I don't think so. I mean, yeah, like they did. They did. They ran it into a brick wall over and over and over again. And a really frustrating thing, Bill, is that when they got in the red zone and desperately needed a touchdown and looked like they were taking control of the game, they did it by running read option to set it. Like Russell Wilson ran those read option plays in the red zone, and they were beautifully designed and beautifully timed. And Dallas didn't think they were coming because Dallas thought Seattle was stupid and was going to keep running up the middle with Chris Carson. And like, if the Seahawks had come out of the gate and opened up with read option, play action, and just not, like, it would have thrown Dallas so far off that they would have then been able to come up and establish the run, I think. And they would have been able to stretch the field and make Dallas's linebackers, you know, back up and you know, keep the defensive line on its toes. And because they didn't do any of that and just thought they could impose their will on a better group of athletes, they lost the game. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, it's frustrating. On the flip side of this, were you impressed with what you saw from the Cowboys? I mean, obviously the big stars showed up. Ezekiel Elliott had 169 yards from scrimmage on 30 touches. Dak Prescott, 6 of 29, and that rushing touchdown, 22 of 33 for 226, a touchdown and an interception that I don't know that was really his fault. An underthrown pass, maybe it's fair to say, but tipped in the air. Great play by KJ Wright to force a pick. Amari Cooper, 7 of 9 for 106. Are you impressed with what you saw? Do you think they have a better shot of winning this week against LA than you would have had coming into the game?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, I've been wrong about the Cowboys a lot this year. I was wrong about them in this game. I'm very curious about two things as it relates to the Cowboys-Rams matchup. One, I'm stunned that the spread for this game was Rams minus 7. I mean, that's a big spread for a team that, you know, they beat up on the Cardinals and 49ers to close out. But if you look at the Rams, this year they've been favored by a touchdown or more 12 times, and they have only covered 5 of those times.
Wow.
One was against the Chargers early in the season. One was against the Lions, who stink. And then the rest were against the Cardinals or the 49ers. And so, I mean, this is a team that, you know, as good as the Rams were early on, they beat up on the Raiders. I mean, they just haven't covered these massive spreads when they've had them. They haven't been a dominant home team. I would anticipate that the crowd in L.A. is going to be pretty full of Cowboys fans, because Cowboys fans are the biggest, you know, transplant bandwagon homers in the country, and they're going to show up. I'm sure there's plenty of them that live in L.A. Looking at this game, though, this is where it gets really fascinating, because, again, we know the Cowboys are good at stopping the run. And what the Rams want to do is establish the run. And we know that outside zone stuff with Todd Gurley is what sets up the play action and gets the flow going for Jared Goff and all of that. They don't have Cooper Kupp, of course. Missing him has been a big, big problem for them. Josh Reynolds just hadn't been the same guy. I wonder how that chess match between Sean McVay, who's had 2 weeks to prepare. He's been very good off the bye in his two we have a small sample size, but I think the combined score of those two bye games is 81-33. That's pretty good. And Rod Marinelli, and like, what is, you know, is Sean McVay going to try to establish the run? Is he going to come out of the gates and try and do the opposite of Brian Schottenheimer and throw up top to Brandon Cooks and sort of get the Cowboys off their, you know, off what they want to do? And then Wade Phillips against Jason Garrett. How freaking delightful. You know, hello, Judas. It's good to see you. It's like a Kissing Susie Colbert reunion or something like that. And I am very curious to see what the Cowboys can do offensively against the Rams, because you have Aaron Donald, you have good interior blockers and Zach Martin and those guys, and you have a team in Dallas that wants to run the ball with Zeke Elliott, and a team in Los Angeles that ranks 28th in DVOA against the run. And this is a really fascinating, like, couple of chess matches here in this game, and I like Dallas. I can't believe I'm saying that. I like Dallas.
You like Dallas against the spread, or you like Dallas straight up?
Both. I love Dallas against the spread. I think 7 is just too much. Rams could easily cover. Football goes weird ways, but I think 7 is a lot for a team like Dallas with its offensive strengths and defensive skill set. And I think the Cowboys. I think the Cowboys are a bad matchup for the Rams.
I could see it. I mean, it's not out of the question. I do think the Rams are going to have some success with play action, which the Seahawks had success, just didn't go to it very frequently in this game. But the Cowboys have one of the worst play action defenses in the league, and the Rams are the most play action friendly team in football. But who knows? I don't know what we're going to get from the Rams come Sunday in terms of or this weekend in terms of their level of play. We don't know who's healthy. We don't know, you know, how who's going to show up for the Rams to some extent. And I think that the Cowboys, you know, I don't know that their ceiling is quite as high as the Rams, but they've been consistent. They've been winning for 2 months now. And even though I think this team's a little overrated, just in terms of their defensive performance, they're still a good football team. And they can run the football, and they can play great defense. They have a very solid defensive line. Offensive line is playing better, I think, than it was earlier in the year. So, I mean, they can win. It's not out of the question to me by any means. But we're going to hit a break and come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined again by CBS's Will Brinson. We are recapping the wild card round. And Will, I was going to wait till the very end, but I didn't think it was fair to you. I want to let you gloat. I want to let you enjoy it. I want to let you luxuriate here on the show. The Los Angeles Chargers have won a playoff game. How did you feel? Are you still in the throes of Chargers ecstasy? Describe to me your emotions after seeing the Chargers, your beloved Los Angeles Chargers, actually win a game in January.
Well, I will say, I mean, I think I've sort of, okay, so I picked the Chiefs to win the division, so people kind of got on me about that. Like, oh, like, you're not, you know, you sort of bailed on the Chargers. Like, I've not bailed on the Chargers, people. I went back and picked before the playoffs again. I picked the Chargers to win the Super Bowl. Couldn't stay away from them. I got to tell you, Bill, that was a hectic 3 hours in my house. My wife took the dog for a walk during the first half of the game and was out of the house for much of the first half and missed me calmly watching the Chargers take a lead, you know, yada, 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 Los Angeles moving along. Well, the second half, she was in the house, and she repeatedly came over to the living room and said, "Please stop. You're scaring everyone." Because I was freaking out, especially at the end when, with the Chargers leading 23-3, everyone is lollygagging around, having the time of their lives. I'm in Slack with my CBS coworkers. They're joking about how this game is over. And I'm like, look, guys, I got to tell you something. I've watched. I got 20 years of Philip Rivers under my belt. Okay, I do not assume that this game is over. And sure enough, the Ravens get the ball back with a chance to win the game. And suffice to say, I was panicking a great deal during that final stretch. But look, I thought that Los Angeles played a great game. Mm-hmm. They, defensively, they were outstanding. They took. And this is really, it's always fun when you're right, not only in theory about what's going to happen in a football game, but in mm-hmm. actuality. And I thought that the Chargers would be able to see what the Ravens did 15 days before when they beat up on them in L.A., to take some lessons from that, to implement a defensive plan that would keep Lamar Jackson and Gus Edwards from running wild, that Phillip Rivers would be more efficient, that Melvin Gordon would be a little bit healthier and able to help out. Mm-hmm. And that's how it worked out. And they, you know, they put 7 defensive backs on the field for 58 of 59 defensive snaps. I think they had 50 snaps like that all season long, according mm-hmm. to Next Gen Stats. That the tops in the NFL was like 18 snaps in a single
right.
game
yeah.
with 7 defensive backs. And you know, Gus Bradley did it a bit out of necessity because their linebackers were so banged up. But the belief was, and Jenny Frentis has a great piece on the MMQB about this, talking to the guys. But the belief was, they felt they could run laterally and keep up with Lamar Jackson and get in position defensively better with the defensive backs. Sort of allowed Derwin James to float back and forth. He's the physical type of guy that can do that. And when they locked down Baltimore for that long, they were able to build enough, you know, build just enough points to hold off the Ravens from making some furious comeback. And that's a heck of a win to go into Baltimore in a very violent environment, loud as all get out. Mm-hmm. And to win like that, and you know, I think it sets the stage for you know, Philip Rivers' revenge tour. Gets to go back to Foxborough for the first time since after the 2007 season when mm-hmm. when he almost beat the undefeated Patriots despite playing without an ACL.
Yeah, it turns out you need ACLs. They're important if you want to
play
football.
By the way, I won't tangent the Rivers ACL thing, but it really is like the most underreported ACL recovery in mm-hmm. NFL history. Because it's 2007, so this is pre-Adrian Peterson's miraculous comeback. Rivers tears his ACL in the divisional round game against the Colts, finishes game with LT on the sidelines in that visor, goes to New England after having like a scope in the course of the week, mm-hmm. and plays in the divisional round game and almost topples the undefeated Patriots, so they lose 21-12. It wasn't really ever that close, but you know, he played the whole game and without the ACL, and then he was ready for training camp. Like, how the hell did that happen? That's medically impossible.
I feel like there's a lot more coverage of Hunter Henry returning from his ACL tear than there was of Philip Rivers in that moment. Granted, I was not covering the NFL at the time, but absolutely. I feel like it was a highly underrated and underreported performance. Think about the Chargers in this game. I think there are a couple of things I want to bring up based on what you said. Number one, like you said, Jenny Frentis wrote a good article on it. There's also a good article on The Athletic about this. Chargers knew what was coming on a lot of these run plays. And I think there was a real benefit to be had when it came to playing the Ravens for the second time. They were the first team to play this version of the Ravens offense 2 times. They played it, like you said, twice in about 3 or 4 weeks. And whether it was Ronnie Stanley's footwork before the snap, whether it was the formations the Ravens were running in, there was a stat people were quoting before the game about how they had pulled one guard like 73 times and the other guard 0 times. I mean, this was a Ravens offense that I think, you know, was impressive in some ways, but also very sort of simplistic and looked like an offense that had been installed in midseason. And they didn't really have an answer for when the Chargers knew it was coming and were able to, you know, slice into the backfield and make plays when they were facing a dominant front four that, in context with knowing or having a good sense of what might be coming, were able to physically dominate, and really beat up the interior of the Ravens offensive line with twists. They had to bench James Hurst at guard during the game because he was playing so poorly and getting beat up by several players, including Melvin Gordon, who I thought was the best player on the field. Or Melvin Gordon, Melvin Ingram, excuse me, the best player on the field.
Melvin Ingram was incredible.
Mm-hmm. Here's the bigger picture thing I would say, though, and I think this really reinforced it for me. I think within 10 years, this is going to be what NFL defenses look like on most plays. And I think it's really important to see that the Chargers were able to run this defense with seven defensive backs, two linebackers who were safeties, and Adrian Phillips and Jahlil Adai, under 210 pounds. They had two safeties who were playing linebacker against the most run-heavy attack in the NFL with Lamar Jackson. And they were able to hold up against a team and a scheme where if you said, okay, I'm going to come out with seven defensive backs in every play, the response would be, okay, well, you're not going to be able to hold up if the other team is going with a jumbo package, if they're going with a tight end and a fullback, or two tight ends and a fullback, and running the ball down your throats. The Chargers stopped that. I mean, that they proved, hey, we can do that with seven DBs on the field. And I think, obviously, like you said, they did this because of injuries. Denzel Perryman is on IR. Jatavis Brown was also on IR after getting injured in week 17. As Ted Wynn pointed out on Twitter, they went in the dime pretty much every snap against the Chiefs a few weeks ago. I mean, this is a defense that needs to play with a bunch of defensive backs and have a lot of good defensive backs, but I just think that's the reality where the NFL is going when you have, an incredibly pass-friendly league, when you have a bunch of offenses that want to throw the ball, that want to rely on RPOs, that want to outquick you horizontally and vertically. This is where the NFL is going. You're going to have a bunch of formations where it's going to be four down linemen and then a bunch of defensive backs who are going to be able to disguise what they're doing before the snap and then chase down your speedy backs and your speedy receivers after the snap. I think it makes total sense. And, I think the Chargers might have accelerated that pretty significantly by doing what they did in a playoff game on Sunday.
And yet someone drafted Vita Vea over Derwin James. I agree with you. I think that, like, it's, I mean, we've been saying this, not you and I specifically, but, I mean, maybe you and I specifically, but everybody sort of been like, you know, the NFL is going multiple. You need to be able to, because, you know, the Ravens sort of countered what we knew to be common sense in the NFL, that you have to pass, you know, all the time, you know, you pass, you have to be pass heavy. Well, they went run heavy. And they happened to catch lightning in a bottle because they went up against really bad defenses or teams that were perhaps underprepared or maybe coming off an emotional victory over their division rival, like the Chargers. And so it was sort of fortunate, the group of teams that they got to face. I mean, I think maybe did we talk about this in December, but they played the Buccaneers, the Bengals, the Raiders, the Chiefs. I mean, it's a who's who of teams that stink in terms of rush defense. And I just don't know that that's going to hold up. It's not going to hold up forever, and it didn't hold up against seven defensive backs. And if you can get these versatile chess pieces that you can move around, like Derwin James, you know, Minka Fitzpatrick qualifies too. You know, like he doesn't get as much hype as Derwin James, and he got drafted over Derwin James, which stinks for Minka. But I mean, you can slide him in the slot. You can you can have him as a safety. You can have him in the box. You can line him up on outside corner. You can do all these different things with these defensive backs to move them around. It's what makes you versatile and able to play not only against modern NFL passing offenses, but also teams that may want to pound the ball down your throat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you need a Derwin James to make this work, but I think we're going to see more players like Derwin James hitting the pros in that sort of role, who had that sort of versatility, you know, over their entire college careers over the next decade. Do you think the Ravens, I mean, obviously we saw Lamar Jackson succeed at the end of the game and throw the ball effectively, but do you think they should have gone to Joe Flacco in the second half?
I don't think there's a right or, I mean, I don't think they have. First of all, I don't think the Ravens fans, and I understand that they're all lit up on whatever sort of drink of choice it is in Baltimore. I imagine it to be extremely strong and potent.
And also laced with Old Bay.
Yes. Well, you know, they have an Old Bay beer.
They have to. They have a must.
Yeah, of course, it's a Flying Dog Brewing Company makes a Chesapeake Old Bay seasoning beer. It's not very good. I like Old Bay, but it's just, I mean, like I like Old Bay on my shrimp and seafood. Old Bay in a pale ale, one is fine. Let's just put it that way. Joe Flacco in his first playoff game ever of his career completed less than 40% of his passes. He had He went 9 of 23 for 39% completion, 135 yards, and a 59.1 quarterback rating, average less than 6 yards per attempt. This is a tough spot for Lamar Jackson to start as the youngest quarterback in NFL history to start a playoff game against a team that had seen him 15 days prior, against a defense that was top 10 by DVOA, sort of underreported there, against Gus Bradley, who's a really good defensive coordinator, sort of floating under the radar too. And I think it sort of got lost as Baltimore fans are booing him, that this is the future of your franchise. And whether you think he's a good quarterback or not, and I do, and I think he's developed over the course of the season as a passer, and I think he'll get better this offseason, I don't think you can yank him out of the starting lineup and put in Joe Flacco and cripple his confidence and cripple your long-term support of Lamar Jackson to try and chase, you know, whatever you might get from Joe Flacco. And Joe Flacco wasn't winning that game under the pressure that the Chargers were throwing at the Ravens. And the other thing that I think is important, Bill, is if John Harbaugh pulls Lamar Jackson out of that game and puts Joe Flacco in and still loses the game, then John Harbaugh is not the Ravens head coach. That is, you are pulling an eject button or pushing an eject button, pulling the parachute string, so to speak. And I think that it's a bridge too far if you decide to do that. And so Harbaugh ultimately decided to stick with Jackson.
Yeah, I think you're all in for that game if you make the Flacco change, because, you know, how can you go there next year and sit there and say, okay, well, Lamar Jackson's our guy, we're not going to make any changes, when you benched him after one half?
Yeah.
Or a quarter, you know, a half and a couple drives of the third quarter. I'm surprised they didn't make the change. I sort of applaud John Harbaugh for sticking to his guns and sort of trusting that they were going to have a chance of winning the game with Flacco. And they did. In the long run, he was right. I mean, they might have made the game, you know, they might have come back if they brought him in a little earlier. I don't think they would have. I think people are forgetting that Joe Flacco was Joe Flacco for the previous 6 years. And I think there may be wish casting that the guy they saw in that postseason run is still the Ravens quarterback, and he hasn't been that guy for any stretch of time ever since. I don't see any reason to think that he was about to become that guy coming off of the bench cold.
He doesn't have some playoff switch. He's not going to like, oh, it's the playoffs. Hold on. Let me win this game for you. It's crazy.
Well, Nick Foles does.
Right. Hey, Nick, you got that playoff switch handy?
So, yeah, I mean, I don't fault John Harbaugh for not doing it. I'm surprised he didn't. When he gave that quote after halftime where he basically said, you know, it's like as Rich Eisen put it, he wanted to reserve the right to bench Lamar Jackson without actually saying he was planning on doing it. It made me think he was going to make the change, but I thought he did a very solid job of coaching that game. And I think they're going to be fine. I think Lamar Jackson is certainly still a work in progress, but like you said, he is the youngest quarterback to start a playoff game. They have a lot of time to develop him, and I think that they should run it back next year with the same defense and with Lamar Jackson at quarterback and John Harbaugh, who seems close to signing an extension as their head coach for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think if you're the Ravens, you would be crazy. I mean, I get that John Harbaugh, you know, got back to the playoffs after an extended period of time away. But this is a good football team that has, you know, found a quarterback, has found something that can work in terms of the running game, has some younger pieces there. I think you'd be crazy to try and find a better coach than John Harbaugh. I just don't think it's out there on the market, especially if you're competing with the Packers and the Browns. Although, look, it's still entirely possible that the Ravens will not want to give John Harbaugh what he wants, which is a lot of guaranteed money, multiple years of security, a lot of control in the personnel office, and he could end up being traded. I mean, I think a lot is on the table with the Ravens, but I think John Harbaugh made it clear by sticking with Lamar Jackson that he does, in fact, want to continue to be a Baltimore.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a period of transition. Ozzie Newsome is now retired after that playoff loss. It's going to be Eric DaCosta taking over in Baltimore, and he, granted, has been in the organization forever. Not necessarily make much of a change at all, but who knows? I mean, there's certainly more uncertainty surrounding the Ravens than there's been at any point probably in the last decade when it comes to their quarterback, their head coach, and their general manager. So let's finish up here, talk about Colts-Texans, a game that I think was, how can I put this? In the first half of this game, the Colts were up 21-0, and they were the better team. I think the game was closer in the first half than the numbers seem to suggest, because the Colts were moving the ball reasonably okay, but they were converting every single third down. And in the second half, when they stopped converting all the third downs, they stopped scoring. That shut down. Problem for the Texans was, even though they had the opportunity to make big plays, they missed on too many of their big play opportunities. They had a pass to somebody, Vincent Smith, who I didn't know was an actual person, until he was not able to bring in a bomb from Deshaun Watson. We saw the Texans make a lot of mental mistakes, some ill-timed penalties. Their running game was not effective outside of Deshaun Watson taking over in the second half. Watson didn't have a great game by himself. DeAndre Hopkins was injured. Jadeveon Clowney went down injured for a stretch during this game. It was a really sloppy performance, but I thought it was closer than 21-7 seems to indicate. I think the Texans could have won this game if they had been a little better on third down on defense earlier in the game. If they just hit some of their big plays on offense that were there. I mean, Watson missed Ryan Griffin for a big play in the second half. So many plays where I think if they hit one or two of those plays, this is an entirely different game for the Texans.
Yeah, and I think, too, that what the Colts did by coming out, and look, you got to credit Frank Reich. We've seen this from other guys who fall under the umbrella of the Andy Reid. I don't think it's like a weeping willow at this point because it spreads so wide with its tentacles, if you will. But the early game scripting, right? I mean, he had the Colts and Andrew Luck set up in great position. Mm-hmm. The Colts have turned into this physical running team. Marlon Mack's averaging 110 yards and 5 yards per carry over his last four games, three of the regular season and one of the playoffs. You know, this is a team that is, I mean, I feel like they are the perception of the Colts is skewed by mm-hmm. our belief that Indianapolis is by nature a soft football team. sort of been thinking this all year, right? Like they're tougher than we give them credit for. And, mm-hmm. I guess it could have been closer. It just never felt like it was going to be close.
Right.
Like it never felt like the Texans were ever threatened. There was never that moment like there was in Chargers Ravens where like, oh, here come the Texans.
I disagree with you there. I don't mean to cut you off, but there was. So when the Colts score, make it 21-7 early in the fourth quarter, the Colts then punt from the 48-yard line. The Texans move the ball. They convert fourth and three. They're in Indianapolis territory, down 21-7, so still a lot of ways to work, but 5:53 left, 5:01 left. They have a first and 10 from the Indy 24-yard line. If they score a touchdown there, they've been moving the ball. They've fenced the ball from the Houston 11 to the Indy 24, so they've been moving the ball pretty comfortably for the past two drives. Then it's 21-14. Then you have that moment of, oh, this could be a game. And from that point forward, they had zero offensive yards. They did not move the ball at all, and the Colts ran out the clock when they got the ball back with 4 minutes to go. So it was there. It wasn't as prevalent, obviously, as the Ravens game, but it was there for a brief moment, and then the Colts took it away because the Colts, like you said, are a much more physically imposing team on the offensive line and were able to run the clock out with 4 minutes to go.
Yeah, okay, you're right. And you know what the difference is? Mm-hmm. Is that my emotional investment in that game versus the Chargers game was significant. I was running it back in my head. Like on Saturday, I was like, oh, whatever. Like, you know, they're going to get it. You know, like, this is an interesting game, but this mm-hmm. is not a great. This is not the start I wanted to the wild card weekend, but this is fine. And then you know, Sunday was vastly different. But you're right. Looking at it, touchdown, touchdown, interception, touchdown, end of half. That's the mm-hmm. Colts opening drives. And then punt, 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 end of game. I wonder, 16 yards, 10 yards, 38 yards for the Colts on those, and then 30 yards on those four punts. Mm-hmm. I don't know that Kansas City is going to be able to do that to them. But if the Colts go punt, 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 punt at any point against Kansas City, they will lose by 21 points.
That's entirely possible. I think what's interesting for me, and I know that DeAndre Hopkins was hurt for a part of this game. He was not the same guy in the second half. Couldn't really get off with that, that AC joint sprain in his shoulder. But the Colts should not be able to stop DeAndre Hopkins. They do not have that cornerback or that defensive back that makes you think, oh, wow, they stick that guy on DeAndre Hopkins and it's going to be trouble. DeAndre Hopkins ended up with 37 yards in this game, and some of that was in the second half. I mean, he had virtually nothing to do in this game from a team that doesn't have that shutdown corner, doesn't have the sort of guys to double-team DeAndre Hopkins and play man and man up, and they play zone. They play Tampa 2 for most snaps, and the Texans had no answer for getting the ball to DeAndre Hopkins, and that really fascinates me. It shouldn't be the case, and yet for Matt Eberflus, clearly he's coaching at a high level, and they were able to take away a guy who some of the best teams in football haven't been able to take away for most of this season.
Yeah, but it's like, I mean, at halftime, go Google cover two beaters. Like, and I don't know, I mean, run something, run any, like, do whatever you, that's one of the things about the Texans and Bill O'Brien that I think is very frustrating too, mm-hmm. is I think Bill O'Brien is simultaneously overrated and underrated. Everybody wants to fire him, but he keeps winning the division and getting to the playoffs mm-hmm. with crappy quarterbacks. He's done a good job developing Deshaun Watson, even though he started Tom Savage last year. They don't have an offensive line. They trusted Lamar Miller. There's so much polarizing stuff about Bill O'Brien that it's almost hard to like sort of to formulate a concrete opinion about him. But mm-hmm. I mean, at some point when Eberflus is running these defensive schemes, I mean, just like figure out a way to scheme Hopkins open, do whatever you have to do. Like Kike Coutte can't be the guy who's getting 14 targets for 11 catches and 110 mm-hmm. yards. It has to be Hopkins. You have to be taking shots down the field. There are ways you can beat it. And Matt Eberflus, I don't know. Do you do assistant coach of the year? He would be my pick for assistant coach of the year for what he's done with his Colts defense this season. It's been tremendous.
Yeah, I think he absolutely deserves to be in the discussion at the very least, and is going to get some head coaching consideration once the Colts are out of the postseason. But I mean, think about them playing the Chiefs this week. It's not out of the question they give the Chiefs a serious game. As Football Outsiders just tweeted as we finish up the show here, I mean, KC and Indy rank 1 and 2 in weighted DVOA heading into the divisional round game. Over the last 11 weeks, I put in my column, or since week 7, and this has been probably the best team in football in terms of their performance. And they haven't played a tough schedule necessarily, but they did blow out the Cowboys. They beat the Texans twice. They beat the Texans once. Twice, excuse me, no, twice in Houston. Beat the Titans twice, who were nearly a playoff team. I mean, this is a really good football team, and I think that, you know, it wouldn't be shocking if the Chiefs, you know, didn't deliver the most impressive performance. Andy Reid's on a bye, that's usually good, but Andy Reid's in the playoffs, which is usually bad. I mean, it's not impossible to imagine a scenario where the Colts do a good job on Tyreek Hill, where they are great running the football against the worst run defensive football with a great offensive line, where they control the clock and Andrew Luck makes plays, and they keep the pass rushers off of Luck, and they're able to move the ball in the passing game as well. I'm still picking the Chiefs, but it wouldn't shock me to see the Colts upset the Chiefs in a way that I think maybe some people would perceive based on those teams on paper.
Not at all, Bill. And I think the other thing, if you want evidence that the Chiefs can struggle with the Colts, let's just mm-hmm. look at the last 5 games on the Chiefs' schedule in 2018. Two of those games were against the Raiders. They won those games 40-33 off the bye, which is that's surprisingly close for Andy Reid off the bye, and then 35-3 to clinch the first overall seed. So let's take the Raiders games out because, you know, Raiders. The other 3 games are an overtime win at home against the Ravens, 27-24, mm-hmm. a loss to the Chargers at home, 29-28, and a loss to the Seahawks on the road, 38-31.
Sure.
The common theme among all 3 of those teams that gave the Chiefs trouble late in the season is that they are methodical running teams, almost to a fault, as we pointed out with the Seahawks, mm-hmm. That are willing to control the clock, take their time moving down the field, use the running game to set up play action. They can get in a little bit of a shootout with you, maybe except for the Ravens, mm-hmm. And they're going to do whatever they can to keep Patrick Mahomes off the field, and the Chiefs probably can't do anything to stop them. Well, that's exactly what the Colts are. I mean, that's exactly what the Colts are. They have Earl Grey, Quentin Nelson, the T-man, who's you know, out here dominating everybody and squatting on him when he's finished with him. Marlon Mack's running through these holes. They have a great offensive line. Andrew Luck is playing as good a football as we have ever seen him play, which is mm-hmm. just delightful, and it's very impressive considering where he was a year ago. Mm-hmm. And T.Y. Hilton can light up anybody for 200 yards. I think the other thing to consider, too, is that Patrick Mahomes, in a couple of these games, we saw it at Denver in week 4. We saw it at New England in week 6. We saw a little bit of it at the Los Angeles Rams in week 11, and then at the Seahawks in week 16. All 4 of those were road games, but they were all primetime road games. And he sort of struggled to get comfortable early on. You wonder if he has some jitters. And although this is a home game, it's a home playoff game in primetime. And I wouldn't be surprised, despite the scripting, if Mahomes came out a little bit shaky because of the atmosphere.
Yeah. I mean, he is someone who, in big games this year, even though he's played very well, of course, he has struggled early in those games. He's missed some throws against the Patriots, against the Rams. You know, and I think the Chargers as well. The Seahawks game, he missed an easy touchdown to Travis Kelce. Not easy, but, you know, a throw that he makes most of the time. So, I mean, you know, I think he's the MVP. He's playing incredible football. I don't think he is going to struggle necessarily, but could he miss a throw or two that maybe he would hit under less exciting circumstances? Wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't shock me given how he's played this year. So I think it's a really fascinating matchup. They are what, the Colts right now? What's the line in that game?
Chiefs minus 5 and over under 57.
57. That's a big old number. Well, do you have an early thoughts on that line and that total?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of like, I don't think you can take, well, first of all, I like the Colts a lot in this game. If you look at both the Chiefs and the Rams were terrible against the number down the stretch. They, you know, they came out of the gates hot, lit up teams, covering early on, and we see those teams fade down the stretch. So it doesn't necessarily portend anything, you know, for, you know, the playoffs. But if you look at divisional games of 4 points or more, since 2009, the underdog has hit at 70% if you take out the Patriots, because they cover every stinking game at home. Right. Yeah, and so I like taking the underdogs in this round. I would lean towards the Colts catching the points with the 5. And, you know, I mean, I think I would go contrarian in this spot on the under. But, you know, I mean, look, 29-28 gets it done. I think the Chargers have a pretty reasonable formula for that. I would be a little bit worried that it turns into that sort of Seahawks game where Andrew Luck's throwing the ball all over the place, Tyreek Hill is carving up that cover two, and all of a sudden it's 30s even, and you've lost that under bet. So I would probably steer clear of that one.
Well, I mean, not out of the question. And if people want to check out more of your thoughts on spread, on gambling, on football itself, Will, you are all over the place on CBS. Where can people check out more of your work?
People can listen to the Pick 6 podcast, the daily NFL podcast, Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. in your inbox, wherever you get your podcast. They can also go to CBSSports.com. I've got some playoff picks and a bunch of other stuff up there. They can go to Twitter, at Will Brinson, where I'm sure my wife will remind me that I'm tweeting too much all weekend long.
They can also check out your wife on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
That is true, at AKW Brinson, if you want to follow my wife. And if you want to see, I have a good luck Philip Rivers doll that she gave me for Christmas at the advice of Tom Frenelli. The Chargers haven't lost since they lost on Christmas Eve, Bill, right? Didn't they lose on Christmas Eve? Or,
I believe so, yes. Lost to the Ravens on Christmas Saturday, Eve.
The Saturday before Christmas Eve. They haven't lost since I was given the Philip Rivers doll in my stockings. So that doll will remain on my person from now until the Chargers lose. So if you want to see a picture of that, you can check out my wife on Twitter.
Are you bringing that to the Chargers bandwagon Super Bowl meetup when they make the Super Bowl?
If the Chargers go to the Super Bowl, I will bring the Philip Rivers doll and see if I can't get a picture with Philip Rivers and a Philip Rivers doll. at Media Day, that would be just a humiliating moment in my professional career.
Finally, some use for Media Day.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, Will, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Believe you're going to be ticketed for February. We have Super Bowl coverage coming, and hopefully it'll be the Chargers. But if not, we'll have you on either way. You do wonderful work, and thanks so much for coming on the show today.
I look forward to doing a live podcast in the Chargers Super Bowl parade, Bill. See you in February.
All right. Thanks so much to Will for hopping on the show today. Like you said, follow him on Twitter at Will Brinson. There's excellent stuff there. And we got more audio coming later this week. We're going to preview the divisional round games later this week. So thanks so much for listening. More on the way.